Now, before we get started, Rob asked me to read a quick note about the COVID vaccinations, as there have been a few muddled messages. It looks like most, but not yet all, local care homes and nursing homes have now been covered, and evidently the last few will be covered very soon. Also, many but not all of those over 80 who are living at home have been vaccinated, and now the process has begun for the over 75s. If you have not yet heard from your GP surgery, you will do very soon. Some people will receive an invitation by letter, others a phone call, and those with a mobile phone should receive a text message. Inevitably, a few of our delightful local criminals have tried to cheat people out of money by offering a vaccination in exchange for payment. If you receive a call or letter or text offering this, ignore it. There is absolutely no charge for a COVID vaccination, so anyone offering to provide one if you pay them is a crook. It's just another scam. If you have any questions about the rollout of the COVID vaccination, you can always call Sue on 01727 765 852 for advice. That number again is 01727 765 852. You probably can't get through to your GP surgery to ask any questions by phone, as they are mostly very busy and the phone lines just ring and ring. Just another quick thank you to all who are sending back the wallets regularly and within 2 or at most 3 weeks. This is very helpful and much appreciated. There are always a few missing or late returns each week, and this does sometimes make it harder for us to get every program out in the post to everyone. If you receive one of the old plastic wallets, that means you've forgotten to send back at least one of the soft wallets. It's supposed to be a reminder. We've also had a small number of wallets posted back without the address label, so we don't know who sent them. Please check that the label is inserted all the way into the pocket on the outside of the wallet, so it cannot fall out on the way back to us. And please make sure the zip is fully closed so that the memory stick doesn't fall out. Thanks. Hello, and welcome to your talking newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden, and the surrounding area. I'm Bill, and this is the Red Saturn programme for Saturday, January the 23rd, 2021. I do hope you're all well and staying safe. The music this week is a bit of bluegrass, played with great aplomb by the wonderful Karavik sisters, who hail from Wiltshire, not a place you'd usually associate with bluegrass, which originated, of course, in Kentucky. However, Laura and Charlotte Karavik are twins who, between them, play all the instruments in the bluegrass field, guitar, fiddle, banjo, mandolin, and play them all brilliantly. This track is from their CD, Over the Edge, and is called Making Horses. They've kindly allowed us to play it on Talking Newspapers. As usual, you'll be able to hear it in full at the end of the programme. This week, following the news stories and radio listings, we have Rupert Evershed's Nature Notes, followed by an article from Hearts Life magazine about the mysterious black squirrel. Then we hear an amusing account of what it's like to be a contestant on the TV quiz show Pointless. We start with the news, and our readers this week are Lucy, Hillary, Penny, and Sarah.
Hello, this is Lucy, and it's great to be helping out with this edition of the Talking Newspaper, and I really hope that you're keeping well. The first article I'm going to read is called Bid to Save Birds Threatened by Homes Plan. A campaign has been launched to protect a red-listed colony of endangered birds from extinction. A colony of tree sparrows found in Tittenhanger gravel pits is threatened by a housing development which could see them become extinct as a breeding bird in Harts. As part of Hartsmere Borough Council's new local plan, the Tittenhanger site has been identified for housing development, with 6,000 new homes planned to meet their targets for the next 15 years. The proposed development by Urban and Civic PLC would be a new garden village known as Bowman's Cross, which both Coney Heath and London Coney parish councils believe will create coalescence between the settlements due to its close proximity. A partnership between Harts Bird Club, South East Harts RSPB Group and the Harts and Middlesex Wildlife Trust is now working together to look at ways the site and its rich wildlife, including the tree sparrows, can be saved. Although the developer has agreed to fund a programme of expanding feeding and nest box provision, campaigners do not believe the tree sparrows will survive the building work and are keen to work on a long-term solution to protect the birds. Subject to any further delays caused by the pandemic, the development process is set to move forward another step this spring with a draft local plan likely to be officially adopted. The public will then have a chance to comment on the proposals as part of the subsequent consultation. Harts Ad columnist and keen naturalist Rupert Evershed, chair of Harts Bird Club, explained why the campaign is so important. Since the 1970s, tree sparrow populations have declined by over 90% nationally, placing them on the red list of birds of greatest conservation concern. Just one small breeding colony survives in Hertfordshire at Tittenhanger Gravel Pits and has managed to cling on thanks to the efforts of the Harts Bird Club's Tree Sparrow Project, providing year-round feeding and nest boxes over the last 30 years. The colony, which is believed to be one of the very last in the southeast of England, now faces the real threat of extinction from a large-scale housing development set to be given the go-ahead this year as part of Hartsmere Borough Council's local plan. In response to this, the Harts Bird Club, working with other local conservation groups, have engaged with the developer to explore what might be done to save the tree sparrows. Over the last year, additional feeding stations and nest boxes have been erected around the site in the hope that the existing tree sparrow population can be encouraged to grow and spread. Efforts are also being made to raise public awareness, not just of the tree sparrow's plight, but also of the very rich wildlife the site has to offer. It's hoped that these efforts will not only save our tree sparrows, but also present a strong case for the whole site as a great place for wildlife. David Utting, Secretary of Hertfordshire Natural History Society, said, "It is in everyone's interest, developers, local authority planners and conservationists, to protect the tree sparrows while maintaining and enhancing the diversity of wildlife in and around the site proposed for new housing." A spokesperson for Hertsmere Borough Council said, "Bowman's Cross is being considered as a possible site allocation in the new local plan for a new settlement. As part of this process, all necessary studies, including ecological, will need to be undertaken and will inform the final decision as to the extent of any development to ensure any protected species remain so." There are some great pictures with this article. The first one is a young tree sparrow, very fluffy grey feathers, two little feet sticking out from underneath, perching on a branch. And the head feathers are a pinky red colour. The second picture is an adult bird, very obviously, and those pinky red head feathers are now a russety brown colour. And the wings are beautiful russet and black flecked markings with a light brown body. And it looks like this tree sparrow has some rings on its legs. So it's obviously being looked after and observed by one of the conservation charities.
Hello, this is Penny. Council places footpath barriers too close together. Wheelchair users and parents with pushchairs could find themselves marooned by barriers introduced to slow down cyclists on a popular pedestrian route. The new barriers are apparently too close together to allow easy access to the footpath at Grind Cob, which links Cotton Mill, Sainsbury's and routes to the city centre and both train stations. Tina Swain, who lives in Cotton Mill, takes the route to work every day and can't believe the council has placed the barriers next to the dropped curb. She said she's appalled by the lack of thought which appears to have gone into the council-installed barriers. "I'm bemused by the position of this barrier, so close to the only dropped curb on this footpath. Parents of children at Mandeville and St Peter's use it daily, as do others with shopping trolleys and mobility scooters. The footpath is sometimes misused by cyclists, but they can jump the curb, while people who need the dropped curb access now have no alternative but to walk in the road. A similar barrier further down the path was partially removed some years ago. The District Council has promised to investigate the proximity of the barriers. Head of Housing for St Albans District Council, Karen Dragovich, said, "The safety gates are being installed to discourage cyclists from using the footpath and slow down those that do. This initiative was undertaken at the request of a ward councillor, who had received complaints from nearby householders about cyclists regularly using the footpath rather than the road to access the railway line crossing. The gates are designed to be far enough apart to allow mobility scooters, buggies and wheelchairs to pass through. We are aware that they may be too close and are now checking to see if that is the case and will reposition them if necessary. Each Grind Cob resident was sent a letter explaining the proposed works and asked for feedback. As no concerns were raised, the work went ahead as planned."
Hello, I'm Sarah.
Sandridge student takes on running challenge for mind. A Sandridge student is aiming to run 300 miles during January to raise awareness of mental health issues under lockdown. Cody Gray, 23, devised the challenge to support Mind, which supports and cares for people suffering from mental health issues, in memory of Sandringham School classmate Oliver Breen, who took his own life in December 2017. He explained, "The motive isn't solely for my friend Oliver, but also for others close to me who currently suffer, and those who are suffering worse or who have developed mental health issues as a result of the pandemic." Cody, a psychology student at the University of Hertfordshire, also works part-time as a healthcare assistant at an eating disorder hospital. He said, "I think it's very important that mental health charities are supported, as currently mental health public services are not easily accessible to those who are in desperate need. The COVID-19 pandemic has exacerbated mental health issues, and this has led to an increase in suicide and a deterioration in mental health, not only in those who are already suffering, but also those who may have never struggled originally. Consequently, the demand for services that Mind provides is at an all-time high." For his challenge, Cody currently runs approximately 10 miles a day, and his journey through St Albans city centre passes his friend's house on the way. He added, "I've been finding the runs probably just as mentally draining as physically. I have blisters all over my feet and aching absolutely all over. Obviously, if I miss a day, that means I have to do 20 miles the next day. And because it's exam time at uni, I missed running one day, so I had to make up for it to stay on track. My friends said they'd donate more if I ran a marathon. I ended up doing one only a week into the challenge, and it was the hardest thing I've ever done. But it was the support and the cause of mental health that kept me going, even when I wanted to quit. Overall, it's been incredibly tough. I did a few 5K runs in the first lockdown, but before that, I'd probably never run more than 5 miles in the Sandringham School fun run. I'm fairly fit, as I train boxing over in Hemel Hempstead at Mamba Gym, but I'm by no means a runner, and I definitely don't enjoy it. I just think it's a challenge, that it's admirable regardless of what sport you do."
Hello, this is Hilary. Here's a story about two St Albans women who've been recognised as inspirational entrepreneurs. Cheryl Luzette, who founded digital marketing agency Wagada in 2011, and Jenny Smith, who set up digital agency Digital Gen in 2009, are being showcased as part of Small Business Britain's F Entrepreneur hashtag IAlso100 campaign. From beekeepers to PPE, tech entrepreneurs to pole dance enthusiasts, this year's campaign celebrates inspiring and resilient female entrepreneurs that have flourished despite COVID-19, with many still growing or starting new ventures. Mum of Two Carol was praised for her work with charities in the local community and beyond. Support for startup businesses by helping them on their digital journey, championing girls into entrepreneurship through career guidance in school, as well as the promotion of female diversity on the St Albans Chamber of Commerce Board. She said, "It's a real honour to be named as one of the top 100 female entrepreneurs of the I Also campaign 2021. Wagada is 10 years old this year, and it has been fantastic to watch our clients grow alongside us as a result of our successful campaigns. The industry needs more female entrepreneurs, and I'm delighted to be able to promote female entrepreneurship in a campaign which highlights the multiple roles that women hold in society and their work." Jenny Smith is mother of two teenagers, both with complex and different medical diagnoses, autism and other medical challenges. She has her own battles with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which causes pain and a variety of other issues. Jenny has been a guide leader for over 27 years, running meetings every week for 24 girls aged 10 to 14 during normal times. She's also a wheelchair basketball table official for junior, national and women's league matches, and is occasionally seen sporting the red official polo shirt of British wheelchair basketball on televised women's league matches. Jenny also provides technological support to St Albans Postbox Initiative, which raised over £26,000 this year for the St Albans Food Bank and Open Door. Jenny added, "I'm delighted to be included in the F Entrepreneur 2021 hashtag IAlso100 list, and I'm looking forward to being part of the campaign this year. I couldn't do this without our wonderful clients understanding and supporting the hashtag IAlso aspects of my life, or the support and dedication of the Digital Gen team, all of whom have multiple roles. To be part of such a diverse group of inspirational women is an honour, and I look forward to learning their stories and seeing the way their hashtag IAlso lives have unfolded." Both F Entrepreneur and Small Business Britain were founded by Michelle Ovens, CBE, who is also the director of Small Business Saturday UK. Now in its fourth year, F Entrepreneur was launched in 2017 to highlight female role models to help and inspire all small businesses through content, stories and events. It particularly aims to showcase trailblazing female entrepreneurs that lead small businesses alongside a roster of other responsibilities, such as volunteering, mentoring, and community support activities. Michelle said, "Congratulations to all the inspiring women chosen to join this year's hashtag IAlso100. Despite the significant obstacles thrown at them in the last year, female entrepreneurship continues to grow and flourish. We need to continue and increase our support for these incredible women and celebrate their amazing strength and success in the face of huge challenges."
The next article I'm going to read remembers one-of-a-kind local legend Lee Bozier. The family of much-loved local footballer Lee Bozier has been overwhelmed by a deluge of tributes in the wake of his recent death. Former St Albans City goalkeeper Lee passed away following a long fight against cancer earlier this month at the age of 52. His widow Donna and firstborn son Sam have shared memories of the popular player as plans get underway for a memorial match in his honour later this year. Lee's career began with Luton Town FC's youth team, but it wasn't long before he began a semi-pro career as a goalkeeper with the club, going on to play with St Albans, Stevenage, Baldock and Hartford. He hung up his boots and gloves as a player in 1999 after being diagnosed with an inherited form of colorectal cancer known as Lynch syndrome. After surgery, radiotherapy and chemotherapy, he received the all clear, after which he was always keen to support anyone diagnosed with cancer and going through treatment. When fully recovered, the pull of the game proved irresistible, and he used his knowledge and experience to manage the London Road youth team, which his son Sam played in from under-7s to under-18s. His dedication for the team stemmed from his own football career, and he took his role very seriously. He wanted the best for the lads, and if the game wasn't going their way, the half-time talk would include the line, "Well, it's not me that's going to be at school with them tomorrow." He knew how important being part of a football team was. It helped with discipline, gave the lads a purpose, kept them fit, and led to lasting friendships, and above all, would help them to stay on the right path. He was extremely proud of winning the league unbeaten during his time with London Road, and also enjoyed the social aspect of the team, frequently found standing at the bar, cracking a joke or having a wind-up after a match. In the mid-noughties, he became the youth club chairman, where he showed an exceptional ability to promote and organise fundraising events to raise the vital cash needed to sponsor grassroots football. Lee kept his lightning-quick goalkeeper reflexes, and as best man at a friend's wedding, he caught the ring after it went flying through the air, but was the butt of jokes about his safe hands if he dropped the ball while playing as a wicketkeeper for the Jolly Sailor. Off the pitch, he was well known as an inherent part of his dad's decorating company, Dennis Bozier Limited. Although he tried other jobs, including the police force, a chef at the Three Horseshoes, and as a doorman at Harry Smith's, the pull of the family business was always stronger, and he eventually took over the firm when his dad retired. He was known across the city, having worked on jobs in many homes, and was always acknowledged by his past customers in the street. His business even saw him working on many churches across the district, including the cathedral itself and beyond to the Diocese of Westminster. A lifetime West Ham fan, he took great pleasure in handing over birthday presents in Hammers bags, especially if the recipient supported another team, and liked to be prepared leaving a pair of glasses in every room of his house and behind the bar at his favourite pubs, the Jolly Sailor and the Plough in Tittenhanger. After marrying his beloved wife Donna and the birth of his second son Zach, he worked as a coach with St Albans City FC EJA under-15s in 2016-17, helping them win the EJA Hearts under-15 league title and advance to the regional playoffs. In late April, after more than 10 years of being all clear, the cancer returned, but this time to the stomach. Despite fighting through his diagnosis with radiotherapy and chemotherapy, and just a few months after his dad lost his own battle with leukemia, Lee suffered complications which claimed his life. His wife Donna summed him up. Lee was one of a kind and will be sorely missed by everyone who knew him. There are some lovely family photos with this article. One of the whole family, the whole Bozier family, Sam, Lee, Zach and Donna. And one of Lee and Donna on their wedding day. And also one of Lee with his younger son, Zach, when Zach's very small, sitting on his daddy's shoulders. And it looks like they're both wearing their West Ham strip.
Shop local. How can you back our independent businesses during the third lockdown? That's the question at the heart of the Hearts Ad's ongoing hashtag shop local campaign. For the past few months, we've highlighted the diverse range of companies and retailers who make up our district, celebrating what makes them unique and encouraging residents to support them online instead of turning to multinational companies like Amazon. As the third lockdown continues, so too is our drive to do what we can to ensure our indies keep trading over the coming weeks. Sarah Gillow from Jewellers Gallio on George Street is one of many traders calling for the community to come together and support each other over the coming weeks. St Albans has a fantastically loyal and supportive community that loves to pop into town and enjoy our independent and colourful high street, but there is a serious and imminent risk that it'll look very different when we come out of the other side of the pandemic. Please shop locally as much as you can in 2021. Every single purchase you make will protect the future of our wonderful historic city centre. Helen Searle from Waterer's Menswear, a family business that's been trading in the city centre for over 80 years, is also encouraging the community to think local first. Our thriving and diverse business community really needs your help. We're struggling. We're struggling to cope with the effects of lockdowns and will remain resilient, but the pressure is now very real. Whatever you might need or be browsing for, please browse locally first. Our independent high street is what makes St Albans an incredible place to live and to visit, so please shop with us and enjoy the wonderful personalised service that you simply won't get when you shop with faceless online retailers. Sally Shepherd from Eve and Adam Beauty Clinic added, "The support of all local businesses and St Albans people has been phenomenal. Well-being is crucial, and it's been refreshing to see people watching out for others and their own mental welfare. Without independent businesses, cities would be a very mundane and mainstream place, with all high streets looking the same. Independents bring individuality, a fresh approach, innovation and mavericks. Small business owners work hard to ensure the best service because their livelihood depends on every transaction."
The following article is a message from the UK government. There's light at the end of the tunnel, but for now, embrace lockdown life. Once again, the UK is living under tough but necessary restrictions as we battle COVID-19. Vaccines offer us hope and a way out, but until then, we must all play our part in together beating the virus. We look at the many ways we can continue to stay at home and enjoy life. As COVID-19 tightens its grip, lockdown restrictions have again been put in place and are likely to remain for some time to come. Schools to shops, work to pubs, restaurants, cinemas and gyms, all aspects of our lives are affected amid the UK government and devolved administration's clear clarion calls to stay at home. Those on the NHS front line continue to bear the brunt of the pandemic, whilst other key workers are keeping operating essential services such as supermarkets, pharmacies, waste collection and deliveries. We can all play our part on the path to freedom. All we have to do is obey the rules. Life in lockdown is undoubtedly different, but embrace it and it can offer new opportunities. Take up a hobby, learn a skill, exercise, read, bake, take up a craft and complete jobs around the house that you've been putting off. New technologies allow us to keep in touch with family and friends, as well as connecting on virtual pub quizzes and classes. There is light at the end of the tunnel, with rules regularly reviewed and the vaccination programme being rolled out apace. But for now, we are in this together, all having a vital part to play.
Those with links to St Albans are invited to help shape the District Council's new Equality, Diversity and Inclusion strategy. The strategy, which influences many of the Council's major policies and decisions, is being replaced with a new one for 2021. The Council is asking people to have their say by responding to a short online survey, which will only take around 10 minutes to complete. The survey asks people what they would do to improve equality, diversity and inclusion in the district, and gives a space to contribute new ideas that would propel the new strategy. The strategy sets out the Council's vision and plans for the next 3 years to make the district an inclusive place where everyone can thrive. The council wants to make sure it reflects diverse communities and that everyone gets a chance to say what the priorities should be. Councillor Jackie Taylor, portfolio holder for Housing, Inclusion and Protection, said, "We are committed to including everyone in the work we do to improve the lives of our residents. To ensure that none of our communities are left out or left behind, we are developing a new equality, diversity and inclusion strategy. It will inform the Council's work right across all departments, and in meeting our key priorities such as providing more social housing and helping the district recover from the impact of COVID-19. It is important that we hear as many voices as possible as we develop the strategy, so I urge everyone to take a few minutes to fill in the survey. To complete the survey, visit the consultations page on St Albans City and District Council's website at stalbans.gov.uk/consultations. The deadline for responses to be submitted is Friday, January the 22nd. All feedback will be analysed and included in a report to the Council's Cabinet meeting in March. Answers are anonymous, although people who would like to become more involved in shaping the strategy can provide their contact details. Anyone who has further questions about the strategy can contact the Council at equality@stalbans.gov.uk. The next article is titled "Alzheimer's Society Receives Cash Boost from Pilates Class." A St Albans Pilates troupe has smashed its fundraising targets through a series of lockdown-friendly fundraisers. Over the festive period, Pilates in St Albans' Ilana Garman teamed up with Alzheimer's Society to organise a series of charity activities, including a city walking quiz and some virtual stretch classes in return for a donation. After setting a target of £250, Sylvia Lowe, the head of marketing at the Society, who joined Ilana to organise activities, said, "We were blown away to raise over £1,500 for Alzheimer's Society, which, like many charities, has been hit hard financially by the pandemic, at a time when our services are in greater need than ever. With one in four COVID deaths being a person with dementia, members of the Pilates class joined events to raise awareness and funds for the charity. Over 60 people, plus dogs, took part in the walking quiz, which took participants across the city, and 130 participated in Zoom stretch classes. Soraya Bowen, Alzheimer's Society community fundraiser for Heart, said, "We are overwhelmed by how our supporters have stepped up recently, in all kinds of ways, to make sure people affected by dementia continue to get the support they need when they need it most. Like all charities, Alzheimer's Society has been hit hard financially by the ongoing pandemic, but it's thanks to supporters like Ilana and her Pilates group for the money they've raised that our services can make sure no one faces dementia alone. Since lockdown began in March 2020, Alzheimer's Society services, such as its Dementia Connect support line and welfare calls, have been used nearly 3 million times across the UK and are proving to be a lifeline. By uniting against dementia, Ilana, her Pilates groups and all those that took part in this fundraiser in St Albans are helping to support almost 16,000 people living with dementia across Hertfordshire. To find out more about how you can support Alzheimer's Society, visit alzheimers.org.uk.
Restaurant delivers food to households self-isolating due to COVID. A St Albans restaurant has gone beyond the call of duty to help isolating households well out of their delivery area. Tava, which provides authentic Pakistani food from its premises in Hatfield Road, was asked to help out through social media by Mariam Khan, who lives in California. Her brother and his wife's family had both contracted COVID and were quarantined at home in Luton. Mariam wanted to find somewhere local to them where they could obtain Pakistani cuisine and have it delivered to their homes. Over 5 days, Tava provided a free meal for the two separate households, which each had five people, providing a mix of curries and side dishes over their period in isolation, even though Luton is well out of their delivery area. They even fulfilled a special request for yakhni, a Pakistani chicken broth, which was made by the mother of the restaurant's owner, Mani Nisa. Mani said, "We're grateful to Marion for the opportunity to feed something back into the community that has given us so much. We hope to see her and her family at some stage and grant us the privilege to serve them in person. As a small business operating in difficult times, we understand the many challenges we all face. If any one of our followers knows of anyone vulnerable that we can help, we're always here to listen and support a good cause." Marion was so grateful for the help to her family in the UK at her time of need and said, "The support Tava provided at this time, I don't think I could have got from anywhere else in the UK. A massive thank you. It's hard to find people with such compassion, even here in the USA. Everyone at Tava would like to wish Mariam's family a very speedy recovery."
Campaign aims to provide food for disadvantaged during lockdown. Can you help provide sufficient food supplies for those who need them during lockdown? Members of the St Albans community, charities and businesses have pulled together to raise additional funds, supplies and meals for existing local resources who provide food to those who need extra support. Facebook group founder Karen Snook is working with Sopwell Community Trust to crowdfund enough cash to provide significant number of disadvantaged families and individuals with a box of seasonal fruit and vegetables, together with an additional voucher for meat, poultry and fish. Karen explained how she first got involved. "I first reached out to trustee Rehana Ahmed, owner of the meeting room, at the end of November, to see if I could pledge to crowdfund for a St Albans food parcel initiative through my Facebook network. We both worked quickly, pulling ideas, resources and logistics together, and by December the 5th had raised £3,000 plus gift aid. So far, this money's been spent on fresh fruit and vegetable boxes for our community. The boxes were huge and packed full of healthy, colourful and seasonal food. Rehana has an amazing team of volunteers that rallied round gathering boxes, unpacking and sorting all of the food and then delivering to our local food bank hubs for collection, as well as to doorstep drops for those more vulnerable or shielding. Following on from the success of the initial Christmas drive, Karen is now aiming to continue into 2021. This is a project that needs to be ongoing. The crowdfunder is still live for donations, and we hope to recreate the boxes for February half term, if not sooner, to provide sufficient food supplies to those that need them. It's a huge goal, and all donations are welcome to help smash it. The charity is always grateful for any delivery drivers that can volunteer their time. To be eligible for parcels, parents must be in receipt of universal credit, have no resource to public funds, or be destitute asylum seekers, so that no child living in poverty misses out. Also, those over 55 years old that are isolated.
The ladies' captain for Aldwickbury Park Golf Club in Harpenden has chosen Rennygrove Hospice Care as the Ladies' Section Charity of the Year. The ladies at Aldwickbury Park will be holding a number of events, sales and auctions to raise money for the charity to help provide hospice at home care for local people. Ladies Captain Kate Bull said, "I feel that hospices are such a worthwhile cause. I like the fact that Rennygrove offers services to support the families of those who are facing life-limiting illnesses." In addition to Rennygrove's hospice at home service, caring for adults and children with life-limiting illnesses in their home, the charity also offers family support services, such as bereavement support, for those dealing with grief. Kate Bull said, "My husband had cancer treatment earlier this year and is thankfully fully recovered, but I know how hard it is to be the partner of someone going through this, and how comforting it is to know that there is support out there if you need it. In the ladies' section, we organise various plant sales, cake sales, jewellery and craft sales, raffles and any other ideas that people come up with. We have a ladies' section charity day, at which we play a special golf competition with various fun additions. I'm really proud of the generosity of the Old Wickbury Park ladies and feel sure that I will be able to rely on them again this year. The fundraising efforts by golf clubs in the region make a huge difference to Rennie Grove. Gemma Ralph, senior community fundraiser at Rennie Grove, said, "Supporting our charity is a fun way to work together with your club to fundraise and help care for local people. Golf clubs and other sports clubs have told us their support of Rennie Grove has been recognised in a positive way among their community, and their members really enjoy getting involved too. We love to see the brilliant fundraisers they come up with. It really does make a difference."
And finally, St Albans MP Daisy Cooper looks back on a week in Westminster and frustrations over the supply of COVID vaccinations. "At the start of this month, I was pleased to visit the new Batchwood Hall Vaccination Centre. It's testament to the extraordinary work of our local GPs, medical and admin staff, and community volunteers that this new service was set up at such incredible speed and is making amazing progress in vaccinating many of our older and most vulnerable residents. Scores of residents asked me why Batchwood Hall isn't open every day. Part of the answer is that they're only being given 1,100 vaccinations per day for 2 days a week. It's very frustrating for residents as well as our local GPs and their admin staff, who can only book patient appointments a few days in advance. But the cause of the supply problem wasn't clear. So I asked the government about its vaccine strategy. Was it A, to restrict the distribution of vaccinations in order to ensure that vaccinations for each priority group is completed in turn? Or was it B, to make vaccinations available to any vaccination centre that has capacity to maximise the overall number of people who are vaccinated? Normally, I'd get a reply in 4 days. As is often the case when quizzing the government at the moment, I just get a holding reply saying, it will not be possible to answer this question within the usual time period. Undeterred, I challenged the PM directly during Prime Minister's questions. I asked him to intervene personally to ensure that Batchwood Hall and other GP-led centres received a greater and more consistent supply of vaccines. He assured me that supply would be ramping up in the weeks ahead, but after I asked the question, similar stories started to emerge from all around the country. Some GP practices said that supply problems meant that they had had to cancel scheduled appointments. Others reported they were turning up weeks after they'd been promised. But the reasons aren't entirely clear. Anyone can understand that there may be teething problems, but it's the lack of transparency that causes so much confusion and anxiety. Meanwhile, the Batchwood jabs continue apace. I'm sure many St Albans residents will have their own fond, if not slightly patchy, memories of the Batch. And over the coming weeks and months, let's hope the vaccination effort is the start of more lasting memories too.
Here is a letter from Bim Afolami MP, entitled "Vaccine Programme Offers Hope." "We've all had a tough 2020. At the moment, 2021 doesn't feel much better, but there is light at the end of the tunnel. We have new effective vaccines for COVID, and we should be particularly proud that Oxford University produced one of the very earliest vaccines in the world. We've started well, both on a national basis and in this area specifically, and we should face the next couple of months with confidence. Though of course the government hasn't got everything right in this crisis, on vaccines we've been ahead of the game. We're vaccinating many more people than anywhere else in Europe. Our drugs regulator, the MHRA, was the first in Europe to approve the Pfizer vaccine back on December 2nd. weeks ahead of the European Medicines Agency. And since then, it's authorised the Oxford vaccine. Kate Bingham, chief of the Government Vaccines Task Force, between May and December, held early conversations with vaccine producers, getting ahead of other countries in the first weeks of the vaccination race. By mid-August, Britain had signed in-principle agreements, securing four types of coronavirus vaccines with different manufacturers. In our published vaccine delivery plan, the government set itself a target to vaccinate 14 million people by mid-February. This is a tough target, but we're currently on track for meeting it. In this first phase, efforts are focused on the priority groups who've been identified by clinical experts: care home residents and their carers, frontline health and social care workers, people aged 70 or over, and clinically extremely vulnerable individuals. These groups account for 88% of the UK's coronavirus deaths. Now, the focus for everyone in government is to get the vaccines into people's arms. In Harpenden, the work is being carried out by local GPs, nurses, and other NHS staff working alongside volunteers from the Harpenden Trust. To finish, I want to highlight the role of community organisations in Harpenden, in particular the Harpenden Trust and Harpenden Cares. Harpenden Cares is a community-led response to COVID-19, supporting hundreds of our vulnerable people at risk. Over 700 people have volunteered through the Harpenden Trust to help at the vaccine centre, and the organisers have done a brilliant job of marshalling everybody and getting people vaccinated. We have a wonderful community spirit, and it shows.
Wild at Home. Hearts and Middlesex Wildlife Trust has relaunched its successful Wild at Home project, offering twice-weekly online learning sessions and wildlife activities to do from your living room. With schools closed and many pupils at home, the charity hopes the project will help keep children engaged with the natural world. The project will feature free, weekly, themed interactive online talks for primary school children, with additional corresponding activities that families can do together at home. Frieda Rummenhall, the Trust's communications officer, said, "The natural world's incredibly important for children's development. We want them to keep learning about wildlife and exploring nature despite school closures and lockdowns. The Wild at Home project provides this possibility from the safety of their homes. Families can sign up to the online events hosted by HMWT's conservation experts for free and get a badge for every week that they've completed. Find out more about this project at heartswildlifetrust.org.uk/wildathome.
A new book of poetry from a St Albans poet has been garnering positive reviews and interest. One reviewer declared Grey J. Wall's The Sound of Revolution as beat poetry at its finest, a sound that urges you to join in the revolution. Collated during lockdown, the collection of poems and a few photos was ironically enabled by this strange year of COVID. Grey explained, "Having been furloughed from my role with St Albans Arts team and unable to get together with my bandmates to play gigs, I found myself with time on my hands to concentrate on compiling the book. I've ended up performing and contributing poems to a number of virtual festivals and events throughout the year, as it's obviously something I was able to do in isolation. Early in the year, I put together a little music and poetry album recorded at the bottom of the garden, which was also well received. So in the summer, with the help of my daughter, we sat down and put the book together. The poems cover a range of topics inspired by Grey's troubadour travels, Extinction Rebellion protests, anxiety, train journeys, and cats. As a keen lamographer, the poems are augmented by some of Grey's atmospheric black and white photos. On his website, Gray states, "These are poems from the barricades of protest, from artistic ventures overseas, and from moments of contemplation and self-healing." He adds, 2020 found me out on the streets fighting for a fairer, safer world, angered by the lethargy and inaction of the traditional political construct. Missing my regular performance tours on the continent, I value now more than ever those connections with the similar and differing spirits overseas, that small, beautiful planet we inhabit. Missing my regular performance tours on the continent, I value now more than ever those connections with similar and differing spirits overseas, that small, beautiful planet we inhabit, putting the world to rights with an after-show beer. These poems come from journeys of discovery, times of struggle, sometimes dark, sometimes silly, empathy, confusion, red wine, crazy times, compassion, and a wry smile. The sound of revolution.
Time for a look at this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, January 23rd. At 4 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra, Rupert of Hentzau is a dramatisation of Anthony Hope's sequel to The Prisoner of Zenda, starring Julian Glover as both King Rudolf and his identical English cousin, Rudolf Rassendyll. At 4 p.m. on Classic FM, you can hear Moira Stewart's Hall of Fame concert, featuring works by Mozart, Vaughan Williams, Ennio Morricone, Dvorak, Chopin, Elgar and Bach, plus the Rachmaninoff piece, which recently topped the all-time Classic FM Hall of Fame chart, covering 25 years. There's more for classical music fans at 6:30 on Radio 3, when Opera from the Met presents a performance of Verdi's La Traviata, recorded last January. And at 9:45 p.m. on Radio 4 in The Y Factor, The Kiss explores whether kissing is the universal trait that people believe it to be. Sunday, January 24th, at 11 a.m. on Radio 4, the guest on Desert Island Discs is the British astronaut Tim Peake. At 11:45, still on Radio 4, and all of these are on Radio 4 DAB Digital and on FM, because there's cricket on long wave, you can hear the start of a new 10-part series called The Battles That Won Our Freedoms. The first episode is titled Freedom from Absolute Monarchy and looks at Magna Carta. Radio 4's The Food Programme at 12:30 looks at the problems with supply chains being faced by the UK fishing industry following Brexit and asks if this is just a glitch or a long-term problem. To Radio 4 Extra at 1 o'clock in the first of a five-part series, Adventures of a Young Naturalist, David Attenborough reads from his account of his early years, including a 1955 trip to Guyana for BBC TV's ZooQuest. The drama at 3 p.m. on Radio 4 is the first part of Dostoevsky's Devils, a tale of revolution and betrayal, which the Radio Times Choice column described as crackling with life as the stage is set for the plotting to begin. At 5 p.m. on Radio 3, the listening service looks at dream teams, exploring some of the successful working relationships in music, including Mozart and Lorenzo da Ponte, Gilbert and Sullivan, and Rodgers and Hammerstein. Hoping Lennon and McCartney may be on there too. At 7 p.m. on Radio 2, in Sunday Night is Music Night, a programme from 2017 is a celebration of music arrangers who have provided scores and compositions for this programme since 1953. On to the working week now, and those programmes which are broadcast at the same time every day, Monday to Friday. Same radio station, same time, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday and Friday. At 9:45 on Radio 4 and repeated at 12:30 each day, the book of the week is I Want You to Know We're Still Here, Esther Sefran Foer's memoir telling the story of her quest to uncover how her family endured and survived the Holocaust across four generations. Of course, on Radio 4 Longwave, there's the option of the daily service broadcast each day at 9:45 a.m. The 15-minute drama at 10:45 on Radio 4 and repeated at 7:45 in the evening continues the dramatisation of C.J. Sansom's novel Lemitation. On Radio 3 at 12 noon, the composer of the week is Joseph Martin Krauss, beginning with his years in Germany, 1756 to 1792, before he left to go to Sweden as a young man. At just after midday, every day on Radio 4, Monday to Friday, and repeated at 10:45 at night, Hayden Gwynn reads from Richard Osman's debut mystery novel, The Thursday Murder Club. In a retirement village in Kent, four residents meet up once a week to investigate unsolved murders. But when a brutal killing takes place on their doorstep, they find themselves in the middle of their first live case. At 1:45 on Radio 4 every afternoon, the series called Bodies continues to look at aspects of anatomical knowledge. And at Radio 4 Extra at 2 p.m, Henry Goodman reads extracts from the letters, memoirs, essays and private notebooks of novelist Henry James. Classic FM concert with John Suchet each night at 8 o'clock kicks off the final week of Great Composers Month with a celebration of Beethoven, and continues through the week with Flore, Tchaikovsky, Brahms and John Williams. And at 10:45 on Radio 3, the SA begins a series of programmes called Odes to Essex, in which five people talk about their love for that particular county. On to those individual programmes, then, that you can listen to through the week, starting with Monday, January 25th. A very topical programme on Radio 4 at 11 a.m, Battle for the Capitol, examines the forces that lay behind the mob invasion of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. earlier this month. At 2 p.m. on Radio 4, a new three-part series of The Interrogation, the crime drama in which suspects are interrogated by D.I. Max Matthews and D.S. Sean Armitage, starting today and continues until Wednesday. In another edition of The Y Factor on Radio 4 at 2:45, Mike Williams asks if people have reason to fear the rise of robots. And at 8 p.m, still on Radio 4, the final part of How the Irish Shaped Britain is called The Hard Road to Peace. Fergal Keane hears the UK's decision to leave the European Union has destabilised what many thought was settled. Tuesday, January 26th, Radio 4, 11 a.m, A Year of Misinformation looks back at some of the biggest stories of the past year and reflects on what has been learned about who spreads disinformation, who believes it, and what people need to watch out for in the future. It's followed at 11:30, still on Radio 4, by Max, the Literary Kingmaker, a profile of Maxwell Perkins, the editor for writers, including F. Scott Fitzgerald and Ernest Hemingway. Mapping Britain's Underworld at 2:30 on Radio 4 Extra examines a £3.5 million research project to map out the complex array of pipes, cables and sewers beneath Britain's streets. Finally at 9 p.m. on Radio 2, there's The Jazz Show with Jamie Cullum, starring new jazz and music rooted in jazz, plus classical recordings and guests, including live sessions. Wednesday, January 27th, you could start your day at 10 a.m. on Radio 4 Extra, repeated at 3 o'clock if you prefer, with another chance to hear Hannah Gordon narrating a dramatisation of Mansfield Park, Jane Austen's 1814 satirical drama about a poor girl raised by her wealthy uncle and aunt. The cast includes Amanda Root, Michael Williams, Jane Lapertuire and Rupert Glenister, and is my favourite Jane Austen book. I read it at A-level. And it made me want to read the rest of Jane Austen within a number of months. Absolutely brilliant, Mansfield Park. At 3:30 on Radio 3, Choral Evensong was recorded in January 2011 in St Paul's Cathedral. At 4 p.m. on Radio 4, Tales from the Stave looks at the creation of My Fair Lady by Alan J. Lerner and Frederick Lowe, perhaps the most successful musical of the golden age of the genre. On Radio 3 at 10 p.m, in Free Thinking, to mark Holocaust Memorial Day, historian Martin Puchner is joined by language expert Michael Rosen in a conversation about codes, graffiti, Yiddish and Rotzwelsch, a language spoken amongst mostly marginalised groups in Germany and Switzerland. Plus a look at new research into the takeover of railways and civic buildings in occupied France. Thursday, January 28th, St Cuthbert, the patron saint of Northumbria, was a hermit and a monk associated with the monasteries of Melrose and Lindisfarne, and he's the subject of In Our Time with Melvin Bragg on Radio 4 at 9 a.m. Still on Radio 4, a new series of From Our Own Correspondent begins at 11, presented, as always, by the brilliant Kate Adie. Radio 4 at 2.15, the drama is Voodoo Macbeth, about a 1936 production of Macbeth by Orson Welles, in which the director moved the action from the Scottish Highlands to a Haiti jungle and employed an almost entirely black cast. 2.30 on Radio 4 Extra, in The Choir Invisible, Ian Hislop explores the lives of the forgotten women of Victorian society, who wrote many hymns of the time despite living in a society rife with sexual discrimination. It's followed at 3 p.m. on Radio 4 by Open Country, which today features the writer Julia Blackburn talking about her love of the Suffolk coastline and the ways in which this ancient seascape has influenced her work. The Phil programme at 4 p.m. on Radio 4 revisits a classic interview with actor and dancer Leslie Caron. And at 8.30 on Radio 4, The Untold. Ron and His Royal Medal tells the story of Ron Russell, who in 1974 helped to save the life of Princess Anne. The Queen awarded him the George Medal, the highest award for civil gallantry. But now at 72 and following 10 years of health problems, Ron has decided to sell his medal. Finally, Friday, January 29th, and nearly the end of the first month of the year. At 9 a.m. on Radio 4, there's another chance to hear Desert Island Discs from Sunday, with astronaut Tim Peake as the guest. 2.30 on Radio 4 Extra, The Gentle Art of Tramping, is a programme from 2012. Rambler Arthur Smith, inspired by his childhood recollections of the tramp as a mythic, romantic figure, ponders whether those nostalgic views hold any weight today. Gardener's Question Time at 3 o'clock on Radio 4. Always an interesting listen. And this week, with Pippa Greenwood, Matthew Pottage and Matt Biggs answering questions sent in by listeners. Then for the Night Owls, Radio 4 at 11 o'clock is Americast. Emily Maitlis and John Sopel bring us the latest from the US political scene, following, hopefully, the successful inauguration of one Joseph Biden. Enjoy your listening week. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable one too.
This is Rupert Evershed reading my monthly nature notes for the Hearts ad. Watch out, you may be stepping on a bird. If spring warmth with May blossom and birdsong defines the moment when we say, ah, it is now spring, then winter finds its counterpart in chill woodland walks, scuffling leaf fall, cracking twigs, mud, and damp, damp, damp. They are the default for winter, broken only by the magic of snowfall or the unexpected joyfulness of mistle thrushes in song. Trudging is a good word for winter, either through leaves, wet grass, or heavy mud. In no other season do we give so much attention to where we place our feet. For one step wrong, and we can be upended and find ourselves seated in the mire. And yet, strangely, it is also the season when I am most likely to nearly tread on a bird. This is not because they are young or injured birds, but because each of these three species is so confident in its own camouflage that it calculates that sitting tight, undetected, outweighs the risk of being trodden on. Only at the very last minute, usually well within 3 or 4 yards, do these birds finally capitulate and explode into flight, vertically, and then off into new cover, where once again they vanish. One of these birds is the pheasant, who, in my experience, has the least control of their nerves. Their upward explosion, usually accompanied by loud calls, nevertheless can make you jump when all about has been quiet. The other two are closer relatives, both wading birds, the jacksnipe, found in marsh edgelands, and the woodcock, found along woodland edges. Both possess a plumage so perfectly matching their preferred habitat that the chances are you will have been within 5 metres of them and never known they were there. The jacksnipe wins the award for the steeliest nerves, and due to its preference for marshy margins, is less likely to be encountered on a winter's walk. The woodcock, on the other hand, may explode from in front of you on any woodland walk, and did so on one of mine just this week. Despite having a Cocker Spaniel dog, so named for being specifically bred to flush woodcock, the woodcock still waited until I was just 5 yards away. Binoculars straight to my eyes, and I caught a brief glimpse of its long bill, nearly 10 centimetres, brown, nondescript plumage, and downward-beating wings. The woodcock's flight always elicits a chorus of scolding calls from the small woodland birds, who I can only assume believe the woodcock to resemble a predator, perhaps an owl or a hawk. It was these alarm calls that once alerted me to a flushed woodcock by Verulamium Lake, from the thick bushes just metres from the constant flow of walkers and dogs. Indeed, woodcock remains have been found on the Abbey Tower, most likely the victim of a peregrine kill, perhaps carried out at night as the woodcock migrated over the town. Woodcock are crepuscular, coming out at dusk to feed or fly and returning to hiding at dawn. This makes them most vulnerable at night, when they face not only the nocturnal hunting habits of peregrines, but also the disorienting glare and dazzle of city lights. Bizarrely, as a result, city dwellers are more likely to see a woodcock in broad daylight, sitting exhausted and bemused on an urban pavement, just recently in Farringdon, London. While woodcock are firmly associated in my mind with winter woodland walks, they do stay to breed, but sadly in decreasing numbers. In Hertfordshire, they are almost absent as a breeding bird, but on my annual spring visits to the more wooded county of Kent, I have been able to witness another peculiar behaviour of these birds. Not blessed with song, woodcock instead fly back and forth over the woods at first and last light, roding. This involves the male patrolling his territory while issuing strange amphibian-like grunts and growls, punctuated by sharp, far-carrying squeaks. Most of us will never get to see a woodcock up close and personal, but maybe on some woodland walk this winter, you will catch a glimpse of something brown and feathered exploding from the undergrowth by your feet and skulking away in flight before you can really get visual purchase. The chances are it was a woodcock.
Hello, my name's Sue. This story is from Hertfordshire Life, and it's called The Mystery of the Black Squirrel. They have spread from their stronghold in Letchworth to become an increasingly common sight in Herts and beyond. But how did the black squirrel get its coat? And is it the thug some believe? The words are by Amy Thorburn. Having unsuccessfully spent hours searching for one of Hertfordshire's most mysterious wild residents, I decided to call it a day on capturing an image of the elusive creature. But as I was driving past Howard Park and Gardens in Letchworth, a black streak shot past the car. Before I had a chance to whip out my camera and snap a photo of the blessed thing, it had scampered into the bushes. Herts is lucky to have an abundance of parks, but something most residents may not expect to see while enjoying a picnic or a game of frisbee is a small jet-black creature flying from tree to tree or making a dash across the open ground. For some of us in Hertfordshire, as well as now Bedfordshire and Cambridge, this is becoming a common occurrence. The mysterious animal? The humble grey squirrel, but with a mutant gene. In Herts, black squirrels are mostly found in the north of the county, in a stronghold in Letchworth and its surrounding towns, according to Herts and Middlesex Wildlife Trust. But these unusual rodents have been spotted as far away as Scotland and Wales. Recent estimates have put the black squirrel populations at around 25,000 in the UK. Comparatively, there are an estimated 2.5 million grey squirrels and around 140,000 of our native red squirrels, which went extinct in Hertfordshire decades ago, a victim of squirrel pox, to which reds are fatally vulnerable but greys immune, and greys' ability to have 2 litters a year compared to the reds' 1. The grey squirrel was introduced from North America back in the 1800s as a fashionable addition to country estates. But where did black squirrels come from? The first wild sightings can be traced to 1912 in Letchworth. It's thought the first black squirrels were brought over from America by the Duke of Bedford for his state at Woburn in Bedfordshire. To discover why they're black, a study was initiated in 2005 by Alison Thomas, Sheila Pankhurst, and Helen McRobbie of Anglia Ruskin University. They discovered that rather than being a separate species, black is just one of the possible hair colourings of the grey squirrels. Their fur can range from grey, as we commonly see them, to brown-black and jet-black. A nut-loving rodent and a deadly jaguar is an unlikely comparison, yet they share the same similarity. The explanation for black hair in squirrels is the same for panthers. The squirrel's colour is impacted by a naturally mutated gene that regulates the distribution of grey and black pigments. If a squirrel has a mutated gene, more black pigment is produced. Completely black squirrels must inherit a pair of these genes. The brown-black version has one, and those with a grey coat have two normal genes. The origin of this mutated gene was a mystery until a new study published last summer. Research by Helen McRobbie, Nancy Moncrief and Nicholas Mundy revealed that the gene responsible for melanism in grey squirrels was identical to a gene causing melanism in a related species, the American fox squirrel. What they believed happened was a kind of star-crossed lovers situation between a grey and a fox squirrel, and the gene was passed between the species. One of the products, or perhaps several of this interbreeding, is in the US, then entered a private wildlife collection in the UK. Since their population expansion in recent years, there have been unfounded media claims, with more than a hint of racism, that black squirrels are more aggressive and voracious than greys. There is, however, no evidence to suggest that the mutated gene impacts squirrels' behaviour. Since black and grey squirrels are the same species, they don't compete for habitat as grey and red squirrels do. And considering the rarity of black squirrels, it casts a doubt on their supposed plan for domination. According to Harts and Middlesex Wildlife Trust, any impact they do have is part of the larger negative impact of grey squirrels on reds. The Harts Biodiversity Action Plan states that grey squirrels also pose a threat to woodland by stripping bark, and the diet has the potential for long-term ecological impacts. Classified as non-native invaders, it's illegal to release a grey squirrel into the wild. Rather than battling greys, black squirrels are part of the same gang causing the problems for woodland and the native reds. Admittedly, because of their rarity and energetic, almost cheeky character, black squirrels remain an exciting animal to come across and can be spotted year-round, but perhaps have some nuts handy, just in case you catch them on a shy day.
DNF soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, this is Rosalind, and this is an account of what I can only describe as a pointless experience. All over the country, around tea time, people tune in to watch Pointless, a television programme where obscure knowledge is to the contestants' advantage. Like many others, I was certain I would do brilliantly and put my money where my mouth was, applying to audition with my friend Declan. We were accepted and summoned to the studios. Be there by noon, they said, so off we went, laden with clothing that observed the Pointless code. No small checks, no logos, no black, and sans makeup, which didn't bother Deck, but I couldn't face the world without mascara. Arriving at the gate, laden with clothing, the security man says knowingly, "Contestants," and in we go. We were ushered to the ground floor of an office block and dumped on a sofa with an oldish chap called Malcolm. He was waiting for his Pointless partner and grandson, Jack, en route from Leeds. There had been flooding on the railway from St Pancras and Jack is running late. Another pair arrive, father and daughter. Jack has rung from St Albans. Seems his train went through Boreham Wood and Elstree without stopping, so he's now getting another one back. All that day's intake were put in a long narrow room with hideous sofas in a row and asked to tick our choice for lunch on a sheet of paper. We were then asked to show our outfits to the wardrobe girls. I'm happy that the two I wanted to wear were permitted and whisked away to be steamed and ironed. Malcolm had clearly not read the instructions, as not one of his five shirts would work in front of the cameras. He had to be supplied with some garment from wardrobe. We were then read 11 pages of single-spaced stuff for legal reasons. This included a step-by-step description of how Pointless is played, which I suspect we all knew, but with Malcolm's inability to read the dress code, possibly was necessary. We then signed our lives away and supplied two emergency contacts. I subsequently told my niece she was one, and she inquired what kind of emergency I had been planning to have. The women were taken to makeup and then to the green room, which was an odd sort of temporary structure, more robust than a marquee, but with a ruched fabric ceiling and curtains along the glass walls. It was furnished with cast-offs from Strictly, a glittery bar which might once have had the judges sitting behind it, some tatty folding chairs, a purple and silver chaise longue, several truly ugly black sofas, and a vast TV screen showing ITV programmes, which seems odd, considering we were waiting to appear on a BBC show. Lunch was delivered in cardboard boxes and was not very nice. There were some contestants who had already been in and were duly called for their second game. The rest of us just hung around, including Jack, whose second train back to Boreham Wood and Elstree had again sailed straight through, taking him back to St Pancras before he finally made it. Also loitering were Andrew and Vijay from Sandwich, Jill and Adam, and father and daughter from Surrey. There were staff everywhere, apparently with very little to do. We were guided from A to B by people for distances of a few yards we could easily have done unaided after the first time. But apart from that, they spent the time chatting. Eventually it was proposed that we played a game of Articulate, a word description game. This was quite revealing. Jill and Adam were ace at it, quickly guessing and moving on to the next word. Andrew was hopeless at describing things to poor Jack. Jack drew out a slip with Marcel Marceau as the thing to describe and had never heard of the great French mime artist, but struggled manfully, saying the first name was the name of the monkey in Friends, which was pretty clever. I don't think Andrew got it. Father and daughter were absolutely hopeless. Father, it's a cold country. Daughter, Iceland? Greenland? Father, we get a Christmas tree from there every year. Daughter, the farm shop. Father, no, it's got fjords. Daughter, oh, Sweden. Father, it's beside Sweden, it's the next country. Daughter, pass. People came out of the third session of the day, and two were seen proudly carrying away their coveted Pointless trophies. Jill and Adam went in for the fourth game, and the rest of us were told they would just get a couple of questions done and then we could go. Some lived close enough to go home. Others would be sent to hotels. Phil, the chap in charge of this, discreetly called Deck out of the green room and out of sight. Deck had already told them that we would need two rooms, but this was being asked again. Apparently the local hotel did not have capacity, so we were diverted to Watford. We waited and waited. Phil thought someone else had told us our rooms were okay, and eventually we went. The hotel was awash with conference attendees, spouting jargon, with little wheelie cases and lanyards. Deck and I agreed that we were thankful, nay delighted, that we would never have to go to a conference again in our lives. Next day, back at the studio, back to makeup, and hey, we'll be in the first game. The studio tour and instructions on the podium shimmy were done. Then we changed our clothes, got mic'd up, badges attached, had a final once-over from makeup, and were off. More instructions came from sundry floor managers. Then the hosts appeared and worked each podium. Xander and Richard are exactly the same off-screen as on. Mics were very discreet, and things like the music actually played when it does on the broadcast. There were a few gaps in proceedings when things were reset, but not long. In the introductory chat, Deck talked about his guitars. Question one was about words that could be made from the letters in the word Armstrong. Deck said angst, which scored very low. When it was my turn, I said matron. In all cases, we were given hints for the definition, so it wasn't that difficult. Not very surprisingly, the father-daughter combo went out in the first round. In my intro chat, I said I enjoyed being able to do lots of things I wanted to do in my retirement, and said only last week I was sticking false eyelashes onto a pineapple. This was to get in a mention of my local food festival, but obviously I couldn't say the dates as we had no idea when it would go out, and in the event it appeared after the festival was over. Next round was where natural gas came from. Name one of the top 60 countries, not BBC presenters. Again, deck was good with Venezuela. Jill, whose husband works in oil and has lived in various oily, gassy places, struck out with Gabon and scored 100. Her son Adam hit back with something so obscure I can't remember and got pointless. By the time it got to me, I didn't need to be reckless, so cast aside Kazakhstan, which I wanted to do, and played safe with Russia. Shame, really, as mine was a high but not too high score, and Kazakhstan would have scored 5. In the end, there was a bit of chit-chat. Richard asked Deck who he would have played had the subject really been flatulent TV presenters, and quick as a flash, he said Sue Barker. This brought the house down. I doubted they would keep it in, but they did. Sorry, Sue. We were now in the head-to-head against Andrew and Vijay from Sandwich. First round was pictures of flatbreads with every other letter removed. Vijay did Matzo, I played Bannock, which won. Then we get questions about Philadelphia, and Deck played a cracker by knowing the needlewoman who stitched the first stars and stripes. Blow me, we've won. Sadly, the money-making categories did not float our boats. Beatles films, Mozart, and two others I can't even remember. Deck was far better than me. But I knew Patty Boyd was in one Beatle film. Seems her presence was not credited, even though she did appear. But as two other people knew this, we would not have won, even if it had been allowed. Still, we got our trophies and then had to dawdle home so it didn't become obvious to Deck's wife we'd only played one game. We stopped for a celebratory drink and every so often grinned at each other and reminded ourselves that we won a pointless trophy. Mine now lives in its shrine in the hall with garlands and fairy lights. It took over 6 months from recording to being broadcast and has got the urge to appear on a game show well and truly out of my system.
DNF Soundings.
We're nearing the end of this week's programme. It just remains for me to thank our contributors, Lucy, Hilary, Penny, Sarah and Sue, and of course John for the radio listings, and Rupert for his nature notes. Steve will be here next week with News Extra, but that's all from me in January 2021. We close with Making Horses by the Karavik Sisters. I do hope you enjoy it. Goodbye for now, and stay safe.